All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Welcome to episode 35 of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. We have got a few things to go through today. So we've got the five things you might have missed that we're going to kick off with in the sec after the preamble ramble. We have some Premier League chat, and then we're going to talk about the Newcastle prospective takeover that should be going through in the next few days. And then we've got the regular combat sports stuff along with the Bronze Bomber versus the Gypsy King, which is going to take place Saturday night. So lovely to see you again, Jim. How's things?
Absolutely spectacular, my friend. And you just mentioning that fight has whet the appetite a little bit. I was planning to stay up for it, but I think the consequences to my overall sleep pattern will be too dire, so I might have to leave it to the morning, but I still might change my mind on the day, because watching the latest build up and all the press conference and all the interviews is just getting me gassed all over again. I was feeling rather jaded before this, thinking, oh, do I really want to see it again? Is it going to change that much? I am 100% all in for this fight, man.
Where is it? Vegas. So it's going to be even the main card's going to be late for me as well. I think it's probably going to be about around midnight for me, I'd assume, because Vegas is 4 hours behind me. So it's going to be a late one for me as well. So, which is good. But so I'm looking forward to that as well. So you have to watch in the morning. It'd be like 6 a.m. for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be ridiculous. I think I am leaning that way, but never say never. If I'm knackered after work and I do a bit of exercise, I could actually conk out at 7 and then just wake up at like 2. It's happened before, man, for sure.
There you go. Perfect. All right, so the preamble rumble this week is from the world of basketball and kind of the general sports climate as a whole, really. So Kyrie Irving is one of the most high-profile sports stars to make a stand against certain sports organizations' rules against unvaccinated players. So he's a player for the Brooklyn Nets, but he will not be allowed near the premises on game day, therefore will not play any home games this year unless he gets at least one dose of the vaccination. New York and California are the only two states in the US that have made it mandatory to have received at least one dose of the vaccine in order to attend any indoor gathering or sports events. This also means that unless the Nets organization intend to move their practices elsewhere, Irving will not be allowed to practice at the Barclays Center. So first and foremost, Jim, where do you stand on this?
Well, I just got a question that might be a little bit obvious. Is Irving like a crucial player to the Nets?
So they've got James Harden, Kevin Durant, who are huge players in the game. And Kyrie Irving is probably up there. He's up there in the top 10, certainly, of players in the league. So he's an important asset to them. But there has been assumptions that the Nets could go and win a title even without him because of Durant and because of James Harden.
He might not necessarily be deemed crucial to the operation, but I'm going off the subject a little bit there. I was going along the lines of, if he's the main man, then the club or the team might be more inclined to move practices for him. I mean, in the US, the state's laws are like, you know, that's pretty much the be all and end all, and like that's what's happening, except for like rare overarching occasions where the federal government gets involved, yada yada yada. Yeah. Whether it's right or wrong, we've gone through this before, haven't we, about the vaccination, about what we think, how dangerous is it really, all that kind of stuff. And if they're only asking him to get one jab, I wouldn't get it personally, but then I'm not a sports star earning obscene amounts of cash. I haven't got like all these financial responsibilities. I haven't got a public, like a large amount of like hundreds of thousands, probably millions of fans, like depending on my contributions to the team. So there's a lot of factors there contributing towards a decision. I don't think it's very fair, to be honest with you, especially when we're not sure about the efficacy of the jabs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, the NBA have said that unvaccinated players will not be paid for games missed, which essentially is forcing the hand of many athletes because, you know, Kyrie Irving, I think he's on a salary of in the region of $32 million, unless I'm mistaken. I can't remember exactly how much it was. I think it might have been around the sort of $380,000 mark that he would miss for his game, for each game that he doesn't play. It's something along those lines. Can't remember exactly what the figures are, but it's a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sports players from other other organizations such as the NFL. There was a high profile case involving Cam Newton at the Patriots, which ended in him being cut. So because of his reluctance to take the vaccine. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think people are too quick to point towards, oh, you being an anti-vaxxer. As you know, both of us, we haven't got the vaccine yet. Obviously, there will be a time where I probably have to get the vaccine as well. But I think the whole point is that nobody should really be forced into making a decision regarding the governance of their own body based on the fact that you're forcing them into, you know, using financial means, or you're forcing them. For example, it would be me. I would have to get the vaccine in order to get my green card. So there's a lot of things that you shouldn't really push people down that road. But saying that, if you're going to lose out on 380 grand a week, you're going to take it, aren't you? You're going to take one shot.
Yeah, it's like you saying, the force in his hand, really. What are you going to do? Stop earning money at the thing that you've been dreaming that you want to do for your whole life, like playing high school basketball, playing college basketball, like putting all your hopes and dreams into this one idea. You're not going to like miss more than a handful of games, really. Like I can see him just like, yeah, just get it over and done with. Let's just get on with the season. I think that's what they depend on with a lot of these policies when it comes to COVID jabs, to be honest.
Yeah. All right. So we'll move on to the five things that you might have missed. So you get started with number one.
When I seen this, I was this was a confirmation of all my wildest conspiratorial dreams. So you got a big up sports journalist, Richard McLaren, for documenting the corruption endemic amongst the Olympic boxing judges in Rio 2016. And I'm sure for countless previous Olympiads as well. Judges were bribed with thousands of dollars hidden in toothpaste tubes, were given secret signals to tell them which way to score bouts, and were visited in the night if they refused to go along with the scheme. McLaren, take a boo, son. Take a fucking boo, son.
Yeah, this is probably one of the more egregious things that we've seen coming out of boxing. Like, it's like every week there's something absolutely shocking coming out from the world of boxing. But this is like levels of like, who wants to be a millionaire coffin, like, you know, for the answer, yeah. You know what I mean? It's on them levels, like what they were doing.
It's cartoonish, man. It's dastardly. It's like they've tried to come up with the most ridiculous way to do it. Do you know what I mean? And look, they're even talking about Joe Joyce having his silver medal upgraded to a gold, because his final against Tony Yoka was really highly debated. Like, a lot of people thought he should have won that. But then if you start overturning decisions like that, we'll be here for the rest of our lives, man. So many people have got fucked over at the Olympics, man.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's still happening in the 21st century in any kind of sport that we love. I think boxing as a whole is due a major cleanup of the shady figures, corrupt officials, unregulated promoters, doped up fighters. You know, it was only a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about that fight where was allowed to fight even though he was doped up. And we're often talking about the need for an independent body or regulator to control what's happening in the sport, and this only exacerbates the urgency at which we need to change. The Amateur International Boxing Association has been suspended by the IOC amid these allegations of corruption at the Rio Games, and only if it comes through this process will the sport have any chance of being involved in the Paris Games in 2024, which is really, really sad and maddening for the sport of boxing and all those that are associated with it in fandom.
Well, it was up in the air whether boxing was going to be included in the Tokyo Games before this was going on. And the whole situation is just rife with missteps, and like all the way from missteps, mistakes, all the way up to rampant corruption. And I don't blame the IOC for wanting to disband that. Would it be a sub-organisation, an organisation within an organisation? Mm-hmm. Let's just get rid of them, clean it all out. But then I think number two on our list is going to illustrate that big organisations, and more specifically sporting organisations, it happens all the time. And I don't think this next example is demonstrating outright corruption, but I do think it's a worrying display of a lack of empathy. So the head of the US Women's Soccer League, Lisa Baird, has resigned. Baird received complaints from players regarding abuse from coaches and has not handled the allegations to everyone's satisfaction. The allegations started in The Independent, centered around coach Paul Riley of the North Carolina Courage, and ran the full spectrum of what any normal person would call abuse. Basically, this guy's a nailed-on pervert who's reportedly done this at different clubs, and Lisa Baird and her staff didn't do enough to address the situation.
I was shocked, really, when you brought this up, because I actually know of this guy from the social circles on Long Island, because he, this guy had a reputation prior to this, for one, and it comes as no surprise that these allegations have surfaced. But a lot of the coaches from the club I work with in West Islip are aware of Paul Riley and have known him for years.
What?
And he used to coach on Long Island with the Long Island Rough Riders. He actually went to Adelphi College, which is 5 minutes from my house, and was inducted into their Hall of Fame in 1999. Oh,
that is so horrible.
Even bizarrely, he played for Glen Cove in the early 90s, a team that I played a handful of games for a few years ago, which is mad, obviously, when they were on the wane. But it's hard to say when his period of misconduct truly began or ended, but the claims are over a 10-year period, so there must have been multiple sources that knew what was happening and chose to stay quiet. Quite clearly, the evidence is emerging of him being a sexual predator and you know, systematic in his abuse of young female athletes. He deserves all the punishment he will get. And I spoke to a colleague of mine, and he... I shouldn't really say his name, to be honest, just in case it comes back on him. But he was saying that he when he used to play, he knew some of the guys that were working with him. Or I guess it's girls. It's only happening with girls. I'm not sure about the extent of what's actually going on. But he said it was rife for years, and people like higher up were turning a blind eye because he was successful in certain clubs and stuff like that. So it seems like it's happening. It's been happening for a long time. He's a Scouser as well. So he's come from Liverpool. He's gone to Adelphi University in Long Island. And then he's sort of like built up through the ranks. He was obviously a player. Then he moved on to a coach. But this is, I think, a systemic and cultural issue amongst the sort of the soccer environment in US.
First and foremost, what a piece of shit. But you would hope that on an organisational level, there will be more safeguards for kids who would just want to play sports. Do you know what I mean? It's supposed to be such a positive influence, a positive outlet, a learning tool for you throughout the rest of your life. And then a monster like this can just come and destroy your existence just through selfish vices and desires and all that stuff. This might be unfair, but I was shocked at Lisa Baird. I kind of expect men to... this is going to sound fucked up, man, but I'm going to be honest with you. I was surprised that she acted as a woman like I would expect a man to act in that situation. Now, that I know that's going to sound unfair and judgmental, but I would instinctively expected a woman to be more sympathetic to what young girls and women have been put through. I was just surprised by that aspect of it, man. I might come to regret saying that, but that is actually how I feel.
No, I do understand where you're coming from, because I mean, at the end of the day, like, you're in a position of power as a coach, and especially when these girls are going to be on the younger end of the spectrum. He's probably been coaching like girls anywhere from the age of like 14 up to like, I don't know, 24 and above when it goes to the actual female league in the NWSL. But so he's coached girls of all ages. You know, as we said before, he'll deserve all the punishment he's get when these allegations are confirmed. Right, so we'll move on to number three. Referee Mark Clattenburg is in hot water over female referee comments. They come in the wake of Sarah Cox becoming the first woman to referee a Premiership rugby match last weekend. And Clattenburg was asked if the Premier League would soon follow. His response was as follows. The problem with women is, which is that, certainly in refereeing in football, they have a difficult pathway if they get pregnant during their refereeing career. It can stop them a long way. So they have a choice to make. Do they want to be pregnant or do they want to be referees? So Clattenburg, who officiated the 2016 Champions League and European Championship finals and also got the moments permanently inked on his arms, went on to claim some women struggle with the men's fitness test to become a referee, adding, certainly when you've had a baby, you're out 9 to 10 months. Then you'll take another 6 months to recover from your body. So therefore, it's nearly 2 years. I would say, Mark Clattenburg, worry about your own refereeing performances and steer clear of topics that make you sound like a dinosaur, basically.
Well, seeing as I've veered into prehistoric territory myself with those comments on the last question, let me go whole hog and just play devil's advocate for a bit. You often hear, say, what was her name now? Jessica Ennis Smith, that's her full name now. Jessica Ennis back then. She was like top dog. Is it a heptathlete?
Yeah.
Anyway, elite level. And she went away, had a kid, came back and continued a success. And she rightly got all the plaudits in the world for that. Oh my God. She's had this athletic career. She's gone away. Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce is another one, the Jamaican sprinter. And I actually think that that is worthwhile, what they're saying. It's completely valid as an appraisal. So he's only saying the same thing, but the way he said it, it sounded derogatory. Do you know what I mean? I have no doubt that it would be difficult for a woman, no matter what her fitness level is, to go through pregnancy, have a kid, go through all the potential problems that encapsulates, and then come back and return to the physical condition they're in before. I think, although he might have expressed it a little bit clumsily, I think he might have some point in there.
Yeah, I think he's coming from the idea of like, oh, when you have the baby, you're going to have to look after it for 2 years. Like, and I think the more modern idea is that it shouldn't be just a woman that's going to look after the baby. So I think that's kind of the angle he was coming at.
He's yeah, like, maybe.
How is she going to progress her career when she's got to look after a kid for the first 2 years or whatever? Do you know what I mean? So I think, I just don't think he should come out with those sort of comments anyway. Do you know what I mean? Just steer clear of it. You know what I mean? Generally.
Yeah. If you're trying to watch your own back, you should definitely give that one a wide berth if he's, you know, interested. But, you know, in the interest of fair comment, man, I can't say I completely disagree, because he's actually like saying that's a difficult thing to do and you're less likely to be successful if you have to go through that thing. But like you say, he just put his foot in it, innit?
Listen, you're always treading on eggshells when you throw your hat into that ring, ain't you? So
yeah.
He's got to be, come on, be a bit more careful, Mark. All right, so number four, Manchester United dropped crucial points in the Premier League on Saturday at home to Everton after drawing the game 1-1. However, in this particular game, it wasn't the performance of star man Cristiano Ronaldo that attracted our attention. Inexplicably, United coach Ole Gunnar Solskjaer opted to leave his key man on the bench, and it wasn't until the 57th minute when Ronaldo was preparing to make his entry into the game that we clocked his shin pads. So he's got a pair of custom shin pads that is depicted with the Portugal crest and a large impression of his own face. Of course he has. He must be the only sports person on the planet that would have a tribute to himself on his own sports gear.
That's nearly a match for the player for Sharif, who had a tattoo of himself dreaming of the Champions League on his own leg. So I cut. This kind of narcissism's rife, isn't it? Come on, for the boys.
Come on, man. Look, if you're the best, man, you're allowed to know you're the best, aren't you?
Also, as well, this is how much of an impact Ronaldo's had on the game. Is it, what's his first name? Andros Townsend.
Yeah.
He did the Ronaldo celebration when he scored against United. That's just like...
he's killing it. Yeah, that's what I mean. He's a cultural icon in the sport, isn't he? Well.
He's just reinforcing that on his own shin pads, just in case, you know, we forgot.
All right, number five. Sunday night in the NFL was the Battle of the Goats. And of course, Tom Brady was breaking NFL records on his first return to Foxborough since leaving to play in Tampa Bay last season. Do you like the way I segued the Goats there? Brady, who was up against his former coach, Bill Belichick, in New England, after spending 19 years together, accumulating 9 Super Bowl appearances, 6 of them wins, he broke Drew Brees' all-time passing yards record, which he set in 2018 after taking the record off Peyton Manning. It was poetic that he should break the record at the home of so many of his joys and memories with his win. Also became the 4th ever quarterback to defeat all 32 teams in the league after defeating the Bucs in 1917. But this wasn't the most shocking thing of the night. Now, let me tell you, New England sports fans, be very careful what you wish for. There were times when Brady was on the field and on his late entrance onto the Foxborough turf right before the start of the game, there was a considerable amount of Patriots fans that could be heard booing Brady. I personally think this is one of the most despicable fan moments I can think of in recent times. You do not boo Tom Brady, especially when he's won 6 championships for you. They should have been ejected by any self-respecting stewards in the stadium. Should be ashamed of yourselves. This would be like Barcelona fans booing Messi when he goes back to the Nou Camp.
You know those stats you just reeled off there? They're absolutely incredible. They're unbelievable, man. And what do Patriots fans want? Did they not get enough of him? The 6 Super Bowls... or the passing yard, like an ordinary human being would be done by now. And just because he went to the Bucs and he's still absolutely smashing it, they've got a problem with that. They should be wishing him well. I'm not being funny. Is this why people hate Patriots fans?
Yes, exactly why. So let me put it into perspective. There's 12 teams, I believe, that have never won a Super Bowl championship. Tom Brady has won 6 for New England. That just puts into perspective the sheer amount of talent and success he brought to New England. And they had the gall to boo him. Like, what on earth? Did they want him to just not play? Is that what they want him to do? Just, no, I can't play against my former team.
I couldn't possibly play after leaving New England.
Wasn't John Terry doing that when he was at Villa, I think? Did he finish his career at Villa and then he went back to Chelsea in the Cup or something? I think it might have been that. He was he was thinking about not playing. Oh, fuck off.
You give off it, man.
Yeah, ain't it? John Terry.
Not like John Terry anyway. He's like full NF anyway, man. Don't like John Terry.
Yeah. Terrible. Terrible geezer. And right, I added one on just because I was reading about this earlier. And just thought this is incredible. This is on the same lines of the eating contest, but actually it's an animal. So as a special add-on to the five things this week, apparently in Alaska, they have a fat bear week contest in which bear they deem to have fattened up the most in the lead up to their winter hibernation. So this year was won by a true champion of the realm as a brown bear named 480 Otis was crowned his fourth victory in this prestigious competition after winning it in 2014, 2016, and 2017. Brown bears can gain up to 4 pounds a day, and Otis was estimated at 900 pounds in 2019, although he didn't win it that year. He has shown unbelievable resilience to come back after 3 years without a championship to reclaim the throne. Well done, Otis.
You know, I like about that, that's consistency. He's won one, he's lost one, he's won one. He's lost one. You know what I mean? He's like, he's in the game for real. Big fat Otis. What a lad, man. I don't even want to call Alaskans Americans because they're a bit different, aren't they? But yeah, only yeah. They would do that.
It's kind of like, are they Russian? Are they American? Are they somewhere else?
They're goddamn rootin' tootin' Americans, boy.
So the fight, the six things that you might have missed was mainly centered around the greatest of all time, obviously apart from the coach. And Mark Lattenberg. So there's a bit of a contrast, really, between the first three and the second three, wasn't it? The first
very eclectic mix. Yeah.
Yeah. The first three were pretty horrible, and the last three were all good.
Feel good stories.
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. That is that will conclude it then. The six things you might have missed this week. Well, we'll crack on straight with the football and the Premier League games from the weekend. Obviously, best place to start was that fantastic game against between Manchester City and Liverpool. So did you manage to watch that one on Sunday?
Just the highlights, but I've got a question for you right off the bat. Do you think Liverpool were fortunate to get the draw?
I think Man City, yeah, I mean, they struggled first half, didn't they? I think they had an expected goal value of like 0.03, which essentially means somebody had a shot from like the 35 yards out and missed. So they failed to create any sort of major scoring opportunities in the first half. Whereas Man City, I think, were a bit more on top of the game. But that second half was just where the true quality of each of the teams and the true quality of the Premier League really just came to life. Salah's goal was incredible. I mean, the first...
Unreal.
The assist for the first goal was brilliant to Mane. Obviously, Mane's just such a clinical player in those situations. But his goal, and it was so similar to that Eden Hazard goal that was at Anfield as well that he scored for Chelsea. I think it was in 2018. So similar, but just his feet to be able to get round. I think was it Ruben Diaz or whoever the centre back was that came out that stepped out to pressure him, and he's just managed to roll the ball over with his left and then like push it with his right, get into that space. And then he beat Laporte. He had him all like, you know, turned inside out and then strike
on
it
his right
goal.
Foot as well.
Oh, he's just an incredible footballer. He will go down as one of the greatest in the Premier League. Well, he'll be in the top 10 strikers of all time when he hangs up his boots, for sure.
He looks like when he turns on the burners like that, and he's got defenders reacting to him. It looks like you literally can't stop him. He's the closest thing I've seen to Messi in his prime. The low center of gravity, diminutive stature, the fact that the close touch, you know what I mean? And he can finish on either foot. He can do outside the box. And he's always alive. He can always find those spaces. And then, like, Mane's finish was ridiculous, you know? He waited until the very last microsecond to put that past the keeper, man. Great finish there. But, again, the sense I was getting from the pundits was, like, papering over a few cracks, really. Like, how many times did Phil Foden break away on that left-hand side? And he only scored the once. He could have had three or four, man. And then, again, to be fair, right at the end of the game, the ball fell to a Liverpool player at the six-yard box, and a City player, a defender, got, I think it might have been Laporte, maybe. He's literally dived and blocked it.
Yeah.
Like, had no right to block it, really. That was amazing, man. That was
That was like a point-saving block, wasn't it, really? I think on the whole reflection of the game, I'd say 2-2 was a fair result. I think, Man City probably did create few more chances, but did they create the better quality of chances? I think in the second half, Liverpool did create quite a few quality chances. But, you know, obviously the talent really, they can score from anywhere. Man City, they got a bit lucky with their second goal with De Bruyne as one, didn't they? Took a big deflection.
Yeah.
But I think a point apiece is probably the fair result.
Do you think Foden should have had a penalty when Milner cut across the back of him a little bit?
I mean, potentially, yeah. I heard a few of the pundits that were sort of agreeing over that. You know, it's hard to say. Obviously, even with VAR, we're still sort of, we're leaving it up to the decisions of the officials that are on the field and in the sort of the fourth officials now. So, I don't know. What do you think? Do you call it?
I would call that a penalty, you know. To be fair, I would say it's at the... That's at the softest penalty I would be happy giving, but I still think it was a penalty. And also, Milner did some like back kick shit to trip over Bernardo Silva later on in the game as well. Potentially shouldn't have even been on the pitch. So I would be feeling aggrieved if I was Pep Guardiola, man. He was going mental on the sideline, and rightly so. That was like classic hometown decision, man. It really was.
And obviously, Milner, I think he was playing right back that game, wasn't he? So obviously, Phil Foden was on that left-hand side. So I think he was causing him problems. And he did pick up a yellow card, didn't he, in the first half, Milner?
I can't remember, to be fair. But I remember those two challenges in particular, because Foden was through on goal for that potential penalty shot, man. I mean, he was really fortunate, man. But to be fair, I like James Milner anyway, so fuck it.
Yeah, and that point. So that point was good for Chelsea, who maintain their position at the top of the league. So they beat Southampton 3-1, but needed a couple of late goals, really, because I think Ward-Prowse scored, was it a penalty, to equalise. And I think they needed a couple of sort of goals in the 85th, I think it was, or a late sort of last 10 minutes to cement that win. So they're looking good, Chelsea, aren't they? They're looking like a strong team. It's going to be the big games between, you know, Chelsea, Liverpool, Chelsea United, Chelsea City. They're going to be the games really where the points are won and lost in the sort of lead up to winning this thing. So how do you see Chelsea? Can you see them continuing the form that they're in?
Well, I'm looking at their standings now, and it says the last one 2 games ago. Who'd they lose to? I can't remember them losing.
Oh, they lost to City, didn't they? 1-0, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Sorry. Brain fart, man.
Gabriel Jesus. Yeah, it wasn't a very memorable game, to be honest.
Yeah, so in terms of can they continue that form? I was watching a really interesting video about Tommy Tuchel, our boy. And I can see he seems like a legit psychopath. So under his tutelage, under his guidance, and with the players they've got, man. I mean, I saw a little bit of a criticism from Conte to Thomas Tuchel, saying he doesn't know how to use Lukaku. And that seems quite...
bitter, really, isn't it? Yeah, sour grapes.
Yeah, a little bit, man. Like,
it's a bit like, oh, I knew how to use him when, you know, or I'd know how to use him when it would... Because was he manager at Inter?
Yeah, that's it.
Conte,
yeah.
That's probably it. So he was coaching him at Inter, wasn't he? So he's gone there and he's sort of like, oh, he doesn't use him correctly. But at the end of the day, even players that you think, all right, this is their best position and these are their traits that lead them to having the most success, you've got to shift them about in different teams, haven't you? Obviously, Chelsea are going to play a different system to Inter Milan. So they're going to deliver the ball to him in different areas and he's going to be doing different things on the field for the team. It's the same reason why Timo Werner doesn't get a hell of a lot of goals, even though he scored against Southampton. He doesn't get back to goals.
He provides
for the teams, man, just of his off-the-ball work rate and creating assists, creating chances for his teammates. So people are going to work in different ways. It's not just a case of like one size fits all with players, is it?
And they're still gelling as well. He's only just gone back there. They've only played like however many games now. Is it 7 games in? He's only going to get better, man. If he stays fit and healthy like he has been, he's just going to keep scoring goals. He's got like Mason Mount. Even though I weren't a fan of him during the Euros, everyone rates him. Werner, as you say, provided plenty. Pulisic probably fell off from that hot streak he had last season for about 6 months, but still pretty dynamite. Havertz, Kante, inshallah. You know, Jorginho, that's a good team, man. Do you know what I mean? So I don't think Alonso as well, one of my dark horse players. I think with those kind of players going forward, man, I think the only team I can see stopping them or outscoring them, really, City, because they look absolutely dynamite when they start putting it together. I do think Liverpool, based on the little bits of footage I've seen and based on the commentary I've seen afterwards, I think like City were really hard done by there. And they're only going to get better as the season goes on as well. So I don't know. It's hard to call. Early days, isn't it, man?
Yeah, still early days. But I think it is going to come down to those, you know, those 6 pointers between teams like Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool, Manchester United. It's going to be those big games really where the points are won and lost. So some of the results from around the league, obviously Arsenal had that 0-0 draw, bit of a dead rubber really, but kind of not a bad result for either team really. Brighton have had a really, really good start to the season. I think they've only lost one from their first 7 games. Arsenal look like they're getting back on track. So
the ship's steadying, and the ship, like, if you stop that Mopay scoring, you're having a good day, man, really. So I'm happy enough with a point there.
Yeah, Leeds get their first win of the season against Watford, home to Watford. Wolves won 2-1. One of their new signings has got 3-4, the Korean, Hwang, I think it's Hwang Mi-sung.
He was the first time I seen him last week. He looked wicked, man. He looked really, really good. So hopefully he can keep banging him away for Wolves in the West Midlands, man. So, just seeing it here now. Leicester, I think you can read their draw with Crystal Palace one or two ways, because it is symptomatic of a definite dip in form. But also, Crystal Palace have looked wicked under Vieira, man.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, Leicester were 2-0 up in the first half, and then they let that 2-goal slip in the second half. But apparently, Crystal Palace were all over them, man, and they were really unlucky to go in behind. But that's no win in the league now since they beat Norwich on August 28th. They've had back-to-back 2-2 draws. Vardy's 6 goals in 7 appearances, not enough to combat their own defensive woes and propel them into the top half of the table. For Leicester fans, it must be quite clear where the problems lie, to be honest. Only 3 teams that have conceded more goals than them. 2 of them are in the bottom 3. So that just shows you kind of where they are defensively. And I don't want to point fingers, but this podcast is predicated on digging players out, so I will. Is Soyuncu a good enough central defender for a team that has aspirations to be in the top 6 every year? I mean, he was extremely poor in the European Championships with Turkey. I think they shipped 9 goals in 3 games, was it? They lost 3-0 to
Italy,
3-0 to Switzerland, and I can't remember what the other result was, but yeah, they were very, very leaky. And now he's struggling to create a meaningful partnership with new signing Jannik Vestergaard, who, on the contrary, had a great Euros with Denmark. So, I mean, they have been unlucky. They've had season-ending injuries of Wesley Fofana, 20-year-old, who I think broke his leg. A player I admire a lot and really, really like the look of. James Justin, who had a great season last year before his ACL tear in February, an injury that we know can take a long time to recover from.
Yeah.
How does Brendan Rodgers approach this dilemma? I mean, I suspect he'd be looking to dip in the transfer market come January, but if they don't start picking up wins, they may be left so far behind that a top 6 finish that it will just be out of the realm of possibility. What do you think Rodgers is going to do? Will he be looking for players in January to come in and fill that gap at centre-back? And if so, what sort of players in the market could there be?
Well, I think Brendan Rodgers has got form for this kind of thing. You'll remember his Liverpool team back in the day, pre-Klopp, and they were inches away from winning the league.
They were a Gerrard slip away from winning the Premier League, weren't they?
But they dropped a lot of points at the back end of the season, conceding a lot of goals against teams that were nowhere near as good as them. He's been at Celtic, he's gone to Leicester now, and he doesn't get talked about as a manager who lacks defensively. But I think because he puts so much emphasis on attack, and don't get me wrong, Leicester are wicked to watch, man. Even now, when they're not playing so well, they're still scoring bags of goals. But I think he's all about going forward. Yeah, he's like a modern manager, like retain the ball, get it forward, bang, like quick passing, all that kind of stuff. I don't think his emphasis is going to be on let's get a towering centre back in January. I just don't really like, that's not the impression I get from him really.
And you know, obviously Leicester, they've got the Thai backed ownership, so they've got money. They've recently won a Premier League, even though it was a bit of an anomaly. And we are gonna talk about sort of new ownership with Newcastle in just a second. But I mean, they certainly need a centre back. So who out there, you know, who potentially could they look to lure in? Would it be someone that was sort of someone like Ben White, the Arsenal sign, they want somebody that's perhaps in that sort of lower to middle of the Premier League, you know, one of those teams in the Premier League that's maybe had a 2 or 3 years experience in the Prem, but that's still got a bit of a shelf life on it. That's someone that they need. But who is there out there?
Oh, I was just thinking, like, which way do you go? Because like United have gone for like Varane, and Chelsea went for Silva. Like, those are people with European experience. Maybe not so much Varane, but he definitely looked like it the other day. Probably on the back end of their prime years. Do you go for someone like Ben White, who we've criticised that decision on this podcast, saying you've spent this, what was it, 50 million
yep.
on a guy who's basically inexperienced? Like, what are you buying for that? And then he gets absolutely run up on the opening day. I think you're playing a really dangerous game, looking for your answers in the transfer market, especially in January, man. Like, what are you getting? We've just talked about Lukaku, as good as he is. He's struggled to gel a little bit. He still looked amazing, but he's not like in full like fifth gear, flying towards defenders yet. I mean, would you really go to France? Would you really go to Spain? Would you go to Germany to get a 30-year-old? Would you do that in January? Is that like?
I mean, if they won, I'd assume that the owners of Leicester want to be a consistent top 16. I can't imagine what else they would want to be after winning the Premier League. That I think they've got the infrastructure there. They've got the players there. They've got the manager there to do that. So they would potentially, if they were going to go along the lines of, you know, Thiago Silva, Varane, signing players that have got a lot of experience, won a lot of things. Someone like Bonucci, for example, try and lure him to the club, pay him a lot of money for 2 or 3 years, that'll immediately solve that problem that they have, I think, at centre-back. And then they can sort of build from there, do you know what I mean? Because it's clearly a defensive problem. That's their pressing issues, is they're just conceding too many goals. So getting somebody in January that is absolutely primed to come in and just lead a defence, someone like Bonucci would be a great addition to me. But is he going to want to go to Leicester, realistically?
I mean, he might. If they give him the bag, he might go. But also, it's like, you know, when you have a highly rated goalkeeper and he goes to a team that have got a shit defence, automatically you'll think that keeper's not very good. But then you see what former Arsenal keepers have done. Like, Szczesny is probably the best example. Went to Juve, he's won title after title. Is it a case of Leicester? Is it just the defence that's bad? Or is it a midfield issue as well? How are teams getting at the back four time and time again? You know, it's like it's a holistic problem, isn't it? I think it's a bit simple to say, you're at centre-back, you're the problem. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it could be a whole issue with the defence. I mean, the James Justin, who can play either, he's a really, really versatile player, can play at right-back, centre-back. So he is a player, really, that they're missing a lot. Do you know what I mean? Somebody that can come in and fill gaps and fill holes. But I just think generally their team is very, very similar to what they were last year and in previous seasons. So realistically, what has changed? I mean, obviously, Vestergaard's come in this season. For me, a good addition. He's a good player. But defensively, they've got James Justin, who's injured. Wesley Fofana, who's injured. Both out for the season. Or James Justin, if he does come back this season, will be slow to recover. Soyuncu, who I think's had a good start to his Leicester career, but not been impressed with him this season, not been impressed with him in the Euros. Ryan Bertrand, is he good enough to be a top six defender?
Probably past it a little bit now as well.
Past his peak. And Johnny Evans. So that
definitely past his peak.
So two of them are out. You know, you basically, what you're left with? Obviously, Vestergaard's in there as well, but Castagna, obviously. Belgian defender, decent. Ricardo Pereira, Portuguese player. Luke Thomas, he's a youth player, so he's not really had that much experience. And Daniel Amati. So, and then you've got Filip Benkovic. I'm not sure too much about him. And Ben Nelson, who looks like another youth player. But for me, there's not much experience there, is there?
With that many bodies as well, and with someone like Brendan Rodgers, who, as I've said, is probably not the most defensive-minded guy, he's probably saying, we're going to have to make do here. Because I honestly don't think it's a good policy to buy in January. I mean, it rarely makes a big positive impact into your team. You end up having to ingratiate a new personality, a new playing style, possibly a new language into the dressing room, all that kind of stuff. It's got a from my perspective, it's got a disruptive potential that might outweigh the on-field benefits of getting that player in.
Yeah, potentially. I think there is always that risk of signing players in January. But if you sign someone that's got that experience, that know-how to be able to perform at the highest level, they can come in and generally their leadership qualities will match the rest of the team. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to bring, and you know, with defenders, they're not really sort of flamboyant characteristically anyway. It's not like you're bringing in a striker that's going to want everything to be revolved around him. Defenders have got a different sort of mentality and different characteristics, but their midfield, like listen to some of these names, Harvey Barnes, great upcoming English player. James Maddison was electric last season. I think unlucky not to get in the England Euro squad. Yuri Tielemans, unbelievable player for Belgium. I think definitely going to be in the sort of like top 20 midfielders as he progresses through his career. Mendy, so Nampi's Menti, who they signed from a French team, and they've had a very good relationship with French players, and obviously their scouting departments at Leicester, we've marveled at for basically the whole duration of this podcast. Yeah. Boubacar Samaire, another product of that sort of great recruitment strategy that they've got, and then Wilfred Ndidi, who's a Nigerian player that I really really admire. I think he's one of the best defensive mids in the Premier League.
And then he's a powerhouse, to be fair, that guy.
And then attacking wise, Jamie Vardy still scoring goals. Ayoze Perez, who they signed from Newcastle, very good player. And Kelechi Iheanacho, who obviously was at Man City, he's come there and he scored goals as well. So for me, the main problem is how do we reinforce the defence? How do we get someone in? I think one or two players, I think, from turning the ship around for me.
Yeah, when you break it down like that, they do have a pretty outstanding squad. And I want to contradict myself here as well. Did Cavani go to United in January?
Yeah, I think he might have been a January signing, yeah.
So, like, look at what he did when he went there. Again, different kind of dynamic as a striker rather than a defender. But we see what an impact. I'm fully contradicting myself now. You can see their positive impact. If you have two or three good games, then all of a sudden everything's sweet. We've seen that with Harry Maguire. Pendulum swinging back and forth. Always shit, always good. Always shit, always good. And he's amazing. Now, do you know what I mean? So you only need a good run, really, 4 or 5 games, and then you just settled into the team. And it could work, man. But my initial instinct was to pull away from that possibility of the January signing.
And you cannot underestimate the power of financial might. And that's something that Newcastle are going to be on the receiving end of when their supposed Saudi-led consortium complete their takeover of the club for a fee of around 300 million. Obviously, they needed to prove that the club would not be controlled by the state itself, which must be against Premier League's rules. Like the stringent rules that they do have. Do you know what I mean? The one or two rules they do have about club ownership and financial fair play. Oh, they care. So the ownership would add to the already existing Eastern Gulf states backing of clubs in Europe after Qatari-backed PSG and Abu Dhabi-backed Man City. So just to put this into perspective, Jim, Sheikh Mansour, the majority owner of Man City, has a reported net worth of around 30 billion and is considered the richest man involved in football. This takeover will see the combined wealth of the Saudi consortium led by Mohammed bin Salman, who is a Saudi prince, amassing an eye-watering 320 billion. So that's how much money you're talking that Newcastle will be able to play with. And obviously they can't spend all this money at once, but what does this mean for Newcastle and the future of the Premier League?
I think they're going to clone Alan Shearer and bring him back. That's what I think is going to happen. I mean, we've seen with City, man, like, this is within memory of us. They were no one in 2005, 2006, 2007. That takeover comes, all of a sudden they're signing Rabinho, like Martin Petrov, Elano, Joe, who, like we were talking about in the chat before, like he was whacked for a good few months. He was absolutely smacking it, man. And then it just built from there and built from there. And then look at the players they got in. David Silva, Yaya Toure, man. Do you know what I mean? They raided Arsenal up good and proper.
Sergio Aguero, who basically transformed that club.
Sergio Aguero, Bakary Sagna, even Balotelli, when he was absolutely ripping it at Inter, man. Like
Vincent Kompany.
So basically,
they started off by throwing money at players that were kind of like trivial, really.
Yeah,
Rabinho wasn't one of the greatest players in the world at the time, but he was a big name. So yeah, bringing him to Man City was like, oh my God, like they're serious about spending money. Do you know what I mean? So it just whet the appetite for the fans. I wonder if Newcastle owners, when this goes through, they're going to do something similar. They'll maybe sign someone. I don't know who I'd put in that realm at the minute of being sort of like, you know, a famous player, but maybe someone like Antoine Griezmann. I'm not sure if they could get someone like that, but somebody that perhaps is sort of a little bit overrated, but a really famous name in the world of football.
I say perfect, but Griezmann's just gone back to Atletico and he's all of a sudden started scoring goals again. Yeah, true. Which is mad.
Which is what every player seems to do when they go back to Atletico, like Luis Suarez, yeah, Fernando Torres. Like, obviously, you got Simeone getting the best out of players. He always seems to get every modicum of like talent out of each player. So
I would say it would be difficult to get marquee name players to Newcastle, but I would also say that James Rodriguez has just gone to play in Qatar and Gervinho went to play in China. Tevez went to go play in China. If you pay them, they will come.
Especially the Premier League. Because at the end of the day, Premier League is the most exciting league in the world. It's the league that everybody wants to watch. It gets eyes on screens. It gets us subscribers. So players are going to want to play there based on that. And they're going to be paid God knows how much money. Obviously, they'll have to still be under the sort of financial fair play regulations that Premier League has. But as long as they're...
Wink, wink.
Yeah. There's ways to get around it. Like, you know, if they invest money into this avenue, that avenue, they're going to build like amazing resources. That'll be something that something Manchester City did. They're going to progress their academy. So it's going to be an era of change for Newcastle, and they're not going to win immediately. You could feasibly predict that in the next 10 years they're going to win a Premier League based on the history of what we've seen with wealth in football, because you can just buy the Premier League. You can, and it has been happening for years. You know what I mean? Chelsea did it, Man City did it, Leicester to a certain extent did it, but they did it in a different way. They were more the sort of money ball. They were the Oakland Athletics of the Premier League, so they did it slightly differently. But at the end of the day, it all revolves around how much you invest. Szymanski, who wrote Soconomics, he spoke about there being a direct correlation between players' wages and success. So the more you pay players, the more you will succeed. There's a direct correlation between that, because obviously you have to pay the best players to win, don't you?
I've seen a stat before. Actually, it sounded like an angry Man City fan, but if this is true, then it's pretty remarkable. We all bow at the feet of Sir Alex Ferguson, but he broke the British transfer record more than any other manager. So that just shows you, I'm not stop trying to piss on his legacy, but as you say, there's a correlation there, man. And I think the first person to get the chop would probably be Steve Bruce, man, to be fair.
You'd Steve get Bunce.
Steve Buncey Brucey, boy. I think that you need to have a suave guy in a suit, a little bit continental.
As soon as they cement that takeover, they're not going to want like Mrs. Doubtfire like managing your football club, are you? I thought we paid great today.
The Janaya Brucey boy.
They're not going to want him there. He's going to be out. They don't care that they're going to want somebody like Mancini. Do you know what I mean? Someone that's going to look good in a suit, got a foreign accent that, you know, everyone's, you know, that's going to be what they want. That's what everybody wants nowadays, don't they? They want someone suave.
Which, ironically, is the perfect embodiment of the Cockney Mafia that the Newcastle fans for years have been trying to get rid of. Do you think they're going to give a shit about that when there's 300 billion in the coffers, man? They're not going to give a fuck. Working class roots, my ass, man.
And it's the pure hypocrisy of football, man. And it is like, honestly, hypocritical football fans are. They really are. And they're so fickle and they forget things that they were saying 6 months ago, man. It's all the same. Every single club, I complain about it, but to be honest, if it was happening to Blues, I'd be like, okay, all right.
Yeah,
at the end of the day, I'm not saying we need owners that are like, you know, from local roots, and we need to keep the embodiment of the club and the culture around the ground. Okay, we understand that. Yeah, but it's gone now. We're past that. My sort of question to you is, where does this end with the Premier League? Like, are we going to see, you know, teams like, I don't know, Coventry City, when they get back up, like being taken over by rich oil oil miners and pumped in billions of pounds into them. Where does it end? Because at the end of the day, not everybody can win the title, can they? There's only one winner every season.
It doesn't, for me, I know you're a proponent of the salary cap and more stringent financial regulations. But look, man, it's obscene the amount of money, not just the players, not just the managers, but the agents, the managers, the player block. People have managers for their own lives. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This there's like a trickle down effect of this wealth, and too many people are leeching on it. Do you know what I mean? Too many worm tongues, too many greedy bastards, too many people who have no function within the world other than latching onto successful people with more money than they know what to do with. It's within all their interests to keep this going. Now, unless there's like a social ill or a social evil that people can talk about and say, this is why you shouldn't pay players that amount of money, the wages are just going to keep going up and up and up.
There must be a point. There must be a collapse point. It's not sustainable. This amount of money that's been pumped in the game cannot be sustainable. Obviously, you know, the NFL is the comparison I make of a good system that they've got in terms of the salary cap and the draft. I'm not saying implement a draft, but I'm saying it would be a different alternative to just having, allowing anybody, anybody that's got any kind of money from exterior components of the social, different social circles. And these billionaires coming in, they buy them as a toy, as like a hobby. So something to basically exacerbate their social position in their own social circles. So, you know, would this, having a different model, would it get away from the buying the league model that we've seen virtually all the winners of the modern era? So to compare it to the NFL, out of all the franchises in the NFL, which is 32, there have been 12 that have never won a Super Bowl, something we spoke about earlier. So dating back to 1966, when the current format was first played, that's 62.5% of teams that have achieved basically the top championship. The Premier League, since its inception in the 92-93 season, has only seen six winners in just under 30 years. Since then, 50 clubs have competed in the Premier League, with Brentford being the latest, making the winners account for only 12% of all the clubs that have competed. So obviously there's the varying factors in the format of the league, and NFL franchises guaranteed to be in the league every single year, where some of these clubs, such as Swindon, Barnsley, Blackpool, only ever had 1 year to play for the title. Nevertheless, it's clear to see there's like a disproportionate chance between the so-called big clubs and the minnows from achieving a title. So that's my kind of issue with it, is like, we're never going to see teams ever compete in this league. So it's going to sort of dilute having those lower league teams in there.
Yeah, but I feel like you're coming from a position where if all money was even, then the competition would be even. I don't think there's any such thing as equal competition. I feel like there's so many contributing factors. Like, even when money was less of a factor, like back in the day, the team who won the first league, right? Was it Preston North End? Is that the first team that won the league?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
Like, okay, whoever, the first team that wins the league, more players are going to want to go there. The more players are going to want to go there, the more coaching staff get involved, the more the infrastructure starts to spread from there, right? And then you've got a head start on your competition. Now, I know what you're saying, that the difference between top and bottom in the league now is getting to a point where literally if you come in, like, but then again, Brentford proven a little bit of an exception to the rule so far this year already. A couple of years ago, Leicester, that was like a magical sporting moment, man. Because, you know, it's all good winning a cup final. They did it for a league. And like you say, they didn't exactly like buy it like City did or Chelsea did, or even to a certain extent like Blackburn did back in the day. There are ways to circumnavigate it. I understand what you're saying in terms of it really decreases the chances of all the other teams winning. But at the end of the day, it's still a game of football, man. And it's 90 minutes and anyone can win.
Yeah, I mean, that Leicester title was a complete anomaly, though, wasn't it? Obviously, you take that out of the equation. Apart from Leicester, when was the last team that wasn't in that big group? It was probably Blackburn, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. 95. Like,
so there you go. So these aberrations are happening every 20 years, essentially.
Yeah.
But by the record. So we could be another 20 years before we see someone outside of Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City, out of those teams, win the Premier League. It could be another 20 years. Yeah. I mean, is that going to garner more interest in the Premier League, or is it going to make people think, All right. They've won it again. You know what I mean?
What do you think, man?
Rotate in between the top five.
The Premier League's more commercially successful than it's ever been. Do you think people have a problem with it? People love it. People love seeing big names on the back of recognisable shirts. They love highlights. They love technical breakdowns. They love celebrations. They love playing FIFA. It's all part of this big machine. People love it, man. They can't get enough. And as long as the money keeps flowing from fans' pockets into the club's coffers, this will keep going. But I do agree with you. It can't be exponential. There has to be something that maybe a wider global financial kind of breakdown will affect it. But in terms of the sport itself, I don't see any reason for it to stop happening, really.
Well, think about it. Who's the losers in this? The fans. Because the more wealth that gets pumped into the league, the more they're going to have to pay players. And that means that tickets prices are going to rise. That means shirt prices are going to rise. And all right, okay. Fair enough. That's kind of the general, the general behavior of an economy is it's going to rise. But as you say, it's exponential, isn't it? It's not within sort of what people are getting paid. So there's going to be a point where, you know, the average working class fan in the Premier League won't be able to afford to go and watch their team. So
it's already there, isn't it, pretty much?
It probably is. Yeah, there probably is. A lot of local Manchester United fans, Man City fans that watched them 20, 30 years ago that think, I can't pay 85 quid a ticket or I don't know what the prices are for a Premier League game there now. So it's just basically tourists, isn't it, that are going? Tourists and, you know, people that have got the money. Kind of getting not quite on the same level as like the UFC. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's where UFC has gone. Like those big UFC, 266, 267, the big competitions, their prices are just extortionate. So the average Joe, like me, can't afford to go. And I think it will get to a point where fans just get turned off by it and then perhaps start supporting teams that are lower down in the league. You know what I mean? Like Oldham Athletic, if you're in Manchester, you go and support Bury or you go and support Oldham Athletic or something. You know, a team that's sort of down there, but they can support because it gives them more of a sort of a better feeling supporting them. Do you know what I mean? A more inclusive feeling.
But that might have a positive effect anyway, because if more people go and watch the smaller teams, they get more ticket sales, they get more money pumped into the club, then their level elevates, not to the same degree, obviously, but
yeah,
that might be a positive consequence of this. So this is like, I'm interested to see what happens with Newcastle, because they're going to want results. It's like PSG, isn't it? They're going to want results within 2 to 3, 4 years tops. And if they don't get it, then what happens? Do the Saudi consortium just drop Newcastle, just shut it off to somebody else? Then Newcastle are back where they are, possibly with the result of a lot of financial fair play, a lot of fines to pay and all that. That could potentially happen. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's the main issue. We'll sort of end this, clear up on this subject. But I think that's the main issue is if they just drop teams, like after, say, 3 or 4 years of pumping money in and they don't have immediate success, what happens to that club? Now they've got these players on extortionate wages. They sell the club for, say, half of what they paid for it, 150, and somebody else picks up for 150 million. And then they struggle with paying the players' wages. Then they go into administration. Then they have liquidity issues because they've got a sort of foot all these loans that they've taken out and God knows what. And that's where the real problems start to arise is when big wealthy owners that have no attachment to the club. They're just using it almost as a sort of like social bump up in their social circles. And then they drop it. And then they're probably, these teams are a lot worse than they were in financial trouble before those owners came in. So that is the real treachery of these billionaires coming in into the game.
I'm going to be very interested to see if this deal actually goes through now.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll see more in the future. So it'll be a big point in the history of Premier League for sure. All right, so should we crack on with the quiz? Because we didn't have one last week.
Oh yeah, that's right. Where is my phone?
So I've had a couple of questions that have just been sort of like sitting on the drive for a couple of weeks. So
good, man.
I think the first one is about is from a couple of weeks ago. So it says on Sunday, but it'll be 2 weeks Sunday. So that's going to be your first question. It's going to be a NFL question. We've got an NFL question. We've got a question about what we've just been speaking about, Newcastle United. We've got a question on the boxing. We've got another question on the football. And then a question on baseball. But it's more that's more of a broad one. You can have a big old stab at that one.
Yes, and all right, I am ready when you are, Bissett.
All right, so on Sunday, which would have been not this Sunday, the Sunday before, Baltimore Ravens kick out Justin Tucker made a new NFL record with his last gasp field goal to defeat the Detroit Lions 19-17. I want to know how long was the field goal.
Haven't even got a point of reference for that.
I think the previous one was 62 yards. So there you go. There's a kind of a point of reference there.
I am gonna have a guess. Okay, 62 yards. What is a humanly possible improvement on that? I'm gonna say 77 yards.
66.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say the average NFL kicker, if it was to pick a yard, jam ahead. Like, if your kicker is about to go up to a 50-yard field goal, nowadays you're like, oh, he could make this. 60 yards, you're like, oh, no way he's going to make this.
So, all right. So I was
66 yards is like, nah, there's no fucking way he's going to make this. What he did in the last minute to take the win. So it was absolutely mad scenes at the end of that game. All right. So number two, earlier we spoke about the prospective takeover of Newcastle United by a Saudi-backed consortium. Newcastle have won four domestic first division titles in their history. I want to know in which decade was their most recent title?
The 1980s.
Now you're about 60 years off. 1926. Oh,
1926.
1926, 1926-27 season. Yeah, so they won a couple in, like, I don't think, like, the 1900s.
Oh, and Liverpool were running right in the 80s, weren't they? Oh, that was a stupid guess. Yeah. Oh, fuck's sake. Oh, 0-2. Oh, my God.
That was a tough one, to be fair.
Good question. That was a good question.
I was like, yeah, I knew they'd never won a Premier League. And I wasn't even sure they'd ever won a top league. And I looked, and I was like, they won four, but they were like ages ago. All right, so the boxing question. Michael Conlon was a victim of the cheating controversy when he was defeated by Russian Vladimir Nikitin in the quarterfinal of the 2016 Rio Olympics. Quite poetically, he ended up defeating Nikitin as a pro to retain the WBO Intercontinental Featherweight title. In which year was this? The Russian Nikitin.
If you can hear some tap, tap, tapping, that's the dog wanting some attention. Sorry about that. He's breathing on me right now. Okay, it's Rio 2016. Da, 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 da. The Intercontinental title, they moved him quite quick as well. Stroking my beard. 2019?
Yeah, there you go. Well in, son. For the boys. There you go. Right, so that's one. Un point. One point. 1 second.
Zig, in your bed, man. In your... Stop mugging me off. Go on. Good boy. He's getting old now. He just does what he wants. Man, just give me the filthiest look ever.
Number four. Watford sacked Cisco Munoz on Sunday after only 10 months in charge. That was the Hornets' 14th managerial change under the club's owners, the Pozzo family, since they took over in 2012. Further cementing the joke that by 2030, one in 10 of all football managers will have coached Watford at some stage. But I want to know who has been appointed as his replacement.
I know this, and I've just heaped masses of pressure on myself by saying that. I saw this the other day.
I didn't know it until today.
Oh, no, man. Who is it? Oh, what's happened to my brain? I haven't even had a drink. Jesus Christ.
He's won a Premier League title.
It's Mancini, isn't it? No. No. Oh, forget it. Go on. Give
Ranieri,
it to me.
Claudio Ranieri.
Fuck. I knew it. I knew that, man. Oh, stuff. I knew that, man. Because I was thinking he's going to be getting pizzas in for the boys and that. Killing it. That was a good question.
Yeah.
And it's just my stupid drug-addled brain. I haven't even taken any drugs today, man.
You were nearly there, man. All right. So, finally, number five. This is the baseball one. So, I'm going to give you half a point for any of the eight teams that you can name that have made the MLB postseason this year. So okay. there's eight teams. So you're going to have, give yourself 60 seconds for this, and I'll give you a point for each.
This is just going to be me naming baseball teams. The Yankees, the New York Yankees.
No, nope, they lost in the wild card game.
The Dodgers.
Yes, LA Dodgers. Yep. That's a point.
The Mets, No, they're a basketball team.
They are a baseball team as well.
Who else? The White Sox.
Yes.
The Red Sox.
Yes. Yeah, you're yes. right. Yeah.
Who else can I think of? The Oakland A's still a team?
Yeah, they didn't make it though.
Oh god, this is so much pressure right now. I'm trying to think who I can't. Even, I don't think I can name any other baseball teams, man. The Cubs? No, they're a football team, aren't they?
Yeah, the Cubs, but they didn't make it. Nah, Chicago Cubs, they're shit.
60 seconds. Sorry, go on. How many did you get? Three.
Three. Not bad.
Point and a half. That is not bad.
There you go. Point and a half. So you move on to 2.5 points. That's going to be the score to beat next week.
That's probably my worst week in the quiz, I think. Who were the rest of the teams? Just out of interest.
All right. So Tampa Bay Rays, they finished top of the American League East. White Sox, who you name? Chicago White Sox. Houston Astros, they finished top.
Yeah.
And then in the National League, Atlanta Braves, Milwaukee Brewers, San Francisco Giants, and whoever won the wildcard game, LA Dodgers.
The San Francisco Giants, man.
Yeah. They were terrible last year, and they went 107-55 this year.
Two and a half points, man. We're going to have to trawl through these quiz results and tally up our league standings, aren't we, at some point. Probably Definitely. Do it in a few months or something.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I'm deflated now after that. Genuinely deflated. That Ranieri one's fucked me over. So, in order to pick myself up, I think we should move on to the combat sports section, man. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, from last weekend, just a quick one, a little bit of boxing, even less UFC, because let's be honest, we want to move on and talk about Tyson Fury, the Gypsy King. So, last week, David Avanesian defended his European welterweight title on Sky Sports with a second round knockout of Liam Taylor. He had Taylor down in the first and promptly finished the job in the second. Taylor was game, and at first I thought the ref stepped in too early, but the replay showed it was actually a fantastic stoppage. At the point where Liam Taylor looked like he was about to be separated from his senses, and I think Mark Lyson deserves a lot of credit there for jumping in at the right time. In the UFC, Thiago Santos beat the formerly red-hot Johnny Walker by decision. Walker briefly looked like a possible challenger to John Jones with his size and unpredictability, but he's now lost three of his last four. Santos now apparently wants the equally unconventional and heavy-hitting Jiří Procházka next, who we've seen devastate. What's his name? Dominic? What's his last name now?
Reyes.
Dominic Reyes, yeah. Absolutely flattened him with a spinning back elbow last time out. He's a danger man. Fair play to Thiago Santos for calling out the younger, stronger opponent. The winner of that will likely go on to face the winner of Jan Blachowicz versus Glover Teixeira on October 30th in Abu Dhabi. That is going to be a banger. I think.
Yeah, it seems like the UFC is in the next few weeks, isn't it? Obviously, we've got those, you know, potential big fights that are going to be in the sort of near future. But then you've got UFC 268, Usman Covington, Nama Yunus versus Zhang Weili. So that's all coming in the next few weeks. And that Jiří Procházka, man, he's so good to watch. Like, he's unreal, so fun to watch, man.
He's like he reminds me of, like, with his hairdo, especially, like what Conor McGregor was first like when he first came out, except he weighs 240 pounds of solid muscle and he's absolutely knocking heads off shoulders. There's a UFC this weekend, but it's a real low-level card. I think it's Mackenzie Dern versus someone else in an Apex show just to keep the ball rolling. You know how the UFC do it. They keep the brand out there. But this weekend, it is a massive, massive Saturday for boxing. Liam Smith versus Anthony Fowler up in Liverpool. Brad Foster versus Jason Cunningham for the European, British and Commonwealth Super Bantamweight titles. That's going to be in Brum. Then, of course, Tyson Fury defends his belt, his WBC heavyweight title against Deontay Wilder at the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas for their third and presumably final bout. As I said to you earlier, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go to sleep. I think I've made my mind up on this one. I think I'm going to have to do it. But that's all to give the fight itself more attention in the morning and not just be dozing off in the middle of what could potentially be a really exciting fight. So let's get to it. The first main event up in Liverpool, Anthony Fowler and his eight-pack have won six straight since losing a split decision to Scott Fitzgerald in 2019. He was dropped in the final round and has since switched trainers from Dave Caldwell to Shane McGuigan, who seems to be like a British Freddie Roach in terms of how many fighters turn to him for a shake-up in their careers. I think Anthony Fowler is basically an unknown quantity at world level, even European level. He had a long amateur career. He's 30 years old already. I'm starting to wonder whether it's too late for him to make the impact that he promised when he turned pro a couple of years ago. By contrast...
Why do fighters like that take so long to turn pro? He wasn't part of the Olympic circuit, was he?
Yeah, he was, but I think... was it 2016? It might be 2016. I know he won a Commonwealth Games gold medal.
Okay.
And I think he might have got a bronze, but I remember he... there was something... Maybe he had an injury going into the Olympics, and then, you know... As you spoke about before, that kind of heartbreak that can hit you after a four-year cycle is just devastating.
Yeah, if you miss that, you're basically, that's eight years in between, isn't it? If you say if you're in the 2020 Olympics, but then you get injured for 2016 and you aim for the 2020, that's a long time in between, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I think because you get a regular paycheck boxing for Team GB, I think that's something that's really difficult to turn down once you go into the world of professional boxing, where you're basically living from paycheck to paycheck,
like a freelancer, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And Liam Smith has been living that life for well over a decade now. He's operated at a far higher level. We're talking Canelo, Jaime Munguia, Liam Williams, and he recently went to Russia and lost the unanimous decision for the WBO light middleweight title against Magomed Kurbanov, which a lot of people thought he edged. He was 2 points away on two of the judges' scorecards from being a two-time world champion. That's the level he's still operating at. Now, going into this fight, I see a lot of similarities in the build-up that I saw when Liam Smith fought Liam Williams back in the day. Liam Smith is saying, basically, you're not on my level. I've got the experience. I've got the grade. You're just an up-and-comer. And they had two fights back-to-back, 2017, 2018. And the first fight, it's as if Liam Smith expected to win just based on his experience. And Liam Williams gave him fits. And it was only a cut to Williams's eye. And he just quit on his stool. Or his trainer pulled him out. I can't remember which. But he out-toughed him. But then he came back in the rematch and he really boxed him up behind the jab. I was really surprised at the extra level that he found. I don't want him to underestimate Fowler because he's made a lot of technical improvements under the guide of Shane McGuigan. His jab's a lot more active. His backhand, he's still defensively a little bit lackluster at times, but he's got a really good chin. So we haven't really seen him come a cropper because of that. I think Liam Smith really showed his level when he battered Sam Eggington in five rounds. And Sam Eggington just went through 12 rounds of absolute hell with that undefeated European lad a couple of weeks ago. So that should be a good fight, man. I'm picking Smith.
I was going to say, would you concur with Smith that Fowler perhaps hasn't got the experience to be able to get on the same level as him?
Yeah, I mean, experience is a massive factor. But then... no one wins the big fight until they win the big fight. So
yeah,
I'd still edge Smith, to be honest with you. And I'm looking forward to that because it's a derby as well in Liverpool. They're a massive fight city and the atmosphere should be wicked. So moving on to the Birmingham show, I wish I knew more about these fighters, but I'd be blagging it, to be honest. I have seen Jason Cunningham box in person, a losing effort against Cal Yafai, who went on to world honours. Cunningham then beat Cal's younger brother, Gamal, for the European belt he's now defending against Foster. And I think it's a curious decision by Frank Warren to bring Cunningham back to Birmingham after he derailed one of our fighters so completely. He really dominated Gamal that night, boxing on the move, setting up traps and counters. He cut up his face and knocked him down three times. If I had to guess, Foster is going to have his hands full on Saturday. There's not much on that undercard either. I think I'm going to try and skip between the Sky Sports and BT Sports shows and see if I can catch both of them. But then... in the wee hours of Sunday morning, though there'll be slightly less wee by the time I watch it, we've got the second heavyweight title fight in a fortnight, a statement that outlines how ludicrous boxing actually is. Just to give us some context, this fight came up after a long series of collaborative fuck-ups. Firstly, Slimy Ed, MTK, and all the other suited sharks announced Fury versus AJ earlier this year. Wilder then took Fury to court to enforce the third fight he was contractually entitled to from their initial deal back in 2018. A long arbitration followed. Fury AJ was cancelled. Then the initial date for Fury Wilder 3 was pushed back when Fury allegedly tested positive for the old COVID. And now, finally, 2 weeks after AJ lost his belts to Alexander Usyk, throwing a match on a dream fight already soaked in petrol, we have the third installment of a trilogy that I think will be remembered rather fondly the further into the past it sinks. Now, Bissett, how much, if any, attention have you been paying to the build-up to this fight?
Not much. I've seen little bits and bobs from social media. So, obviously, we spoke about the fight briefly with Tino last week, didn't we? And how we sort of, how we envision the fight actually going on. I've read a lot about, you know, training regimes with Wilder, him looking different in to his build up to the second installment of this fight. So my question really is, can you see realistically see Fury getting knocked out by Wilder? Because that is the only path to victory realistically for Wilder, isn't it? He's not going to outbox Fury. Yeah. You know that for certain. He's going to be the massive favorite, isn't he, Fury? So can you see realistically, he's what, 3-1 favorite, 3-1 outsider to win that fight? For me, that's not value. I can't see him knocking him out either. So for me, I can't look past Fury.
I think there's two perspectives to examine this fight from. There's the technical perspective and there is the emotional perspective. We'll start with the latter. I think Deontay Wilder has shown a worrying inability to accept the reality of what happened in that second fight. And I think even up to the press conference, I think the video came out this morning, he was still talking about these excuses, vague allusions to his state before the fight, calling Fury a cheater. And you know what? Fury did what Fury always does. He had him by the bollocks at the press conference. He said, look, if I cheated, if I broke all these rules, why did you sack your team? Why have you made all these improvements? Why have you changed your training regime? What's going on? He's like, he's telling Fury he's got no power. And he's like, mate, I knocked you out in the second. Well, what are you talking about? Deontay Wilder, for as magnificent an athlete as he is, for as scary as a puncher as he is, I still don't think he's come to terms with what's happened to him. And I think that's going to cost him. I think you have to be honest with yourself. I mean, it might be that he's just got a shield up to the public. Maybe he's had these conversations in private, but I don't think it's even been hinted at that he said, all right, I've got beaten by the better man. Now, bear in mind, listen, Fury's a handful. He's a lot bigger than Wilder. And when he wants to be aggressive, he's really scary. I'm not saying I don't understand like why Wilder might shy away from that kind of challenge, but how are you going to improve if you're not willing to accept what happened in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Sticking on to the sort of the psyche of boxers, you can't imagine it's within his sort of mental preparation for a fight if he hasn't acknowledged the fact that he was soundly beaten in that second fight, which is what happened. If he hasn't acknowledged that and he hasn't come to terms with that, how on earth can he expect to improve that performance? Do you know what I mean? Because surely it's just going to be the same thing all over again. If he hasn't mentally got into that state where it's all right, he beat me soundly, I need to improve this, this and that. But as you say, it could be just a build-up that's sort of like playing up to the media, and it could be part of the whole charade that we see from fighters in boxing. And he could have been doing a lot of work behind the scenes. It'll be interesting to see that.
And by contrast, Fury, regardless of the personal problems he's had, when it comes to fight time, mentally, he's a juggernaut. Do you know what I mean? He looks for every advantage that he can get. It's real, like, art of war type shit, what Fury does. I thought it was really telling that Deontay Wilder started that press conference, the latest press conference before the weigh-ins and that, and he sat down and he was like, I'm basically not speaking. What can I say that hasn't already been said? Fury got on the mic for about 30 seconds, and he had Wilder biting at him, arguing back and forth. He's playing him like a fiddle, man, already. He doesn't even realise what's going on. And I think this is all part of Fury's game plan. That's the emotional stuff to one side. Technically, I think there's a real chance that Deontay Wilder could knock Fury out. There's a real chance that he could do that to anyone on the planet. All Fury has to do is get overconfident, lazy, a little bit complacent, like he did in the final round of that first fight. And that is a big shot that's going to put your lights out, man. And, you know, it makes you want to be religious when you see that final round with Fury in the first fight, because you think, how did he get up?
Yeah, how on earth?
How did he get up from that? And I was in the building, man. I was there in person. I still have no idea. I've watched countless replays, all to the, you know, operatic music that makes me want to cry. And
is that The Undertaker?
It's astounding, man. It's really astounding. I don't think you can count on that happening again. I think if you get knocked unconscious, 95% of the time you stay unconscious. And I don't think Fury can, and I don't think he will take that chance. I think he found the perfect game plan to beat Wilder in the second fight. He put it on him straight away. He took a few early right hands. He took him clean, but his feet are so good that he's able to kind of glide away, kind of turn his head, take the weight
off the punch a little bit.
Although they still would have been heavy shots, don't get me wrong, but he went into it fearless, knowing that he's going to have to do that. And I think it's a big ask to expect Deontay Wilder to learn how to throw punches on the move, because he can't do that. And Fury can do that. There were times in that second fight where Fury would land a good shot, Wilder would give ground and take one step away, try and turn the corner a little bit to reset. And Fury would follow him, punching the whole time. He can punch, switching stances, going forward, going backwards. He's feinting. He's going head, body. There's so many options there that Fury can do. We spoke about this so many times. He's so mobile. He's so dexterous, confusingly athletic. And he was following him around, conventional, throws a right hand. Wilder steps that way. He switches southpaw. He's following him in southpaw, throwing. I don't think he's got the technical know-how. And I think once you get hurt, you just revert to what you know, don't you? And then the one thing I haven't seen him do was go to the body, really. Fury went to the body a lot in that second fight, leaning all over him, pulling his head down, uppercutting him, little dirty tricks, call him dirty, within the rules if the ref doesn't call him. I don't even know if going to the body will do Wilder any good, because Fury will take one shot and then he'll just be lying all over him, driving him back to the ropes, messing him about, throwing in shots to his ribs and all that. I don't want to get overconfident on the British side, but it's like we said with Tino last week, man. I can see it, the knockout coming again, and I can see it coming spectacular this time. Now, again, with the rocket launcher that Wilder's got in his right hand, could just put that all to shit in a minute, but I'm going with Fury by first half KO, man, within six.
Because I think that's what makes it such an intriguing contest, isn't it? Because if there were two fighters that were both technically matched, you know, and they could both bob and weave, you know, very good technical boxes, could get out of each other's way. The fact that there's such contrast in styles, this is what we look for, especially in the heavyweight division, yeah. You know what I mean? This is what we look for, man. And a fighter that's like very, very gifted, can do it all, has got a lot in his locker. Then you come up against a guy that can basically knock any man on the planet out with one punch. This is what we're waiting for, man. Building up for this.
And I think if the second fight hadn't ended so conclusively, i.e. Fury done a serious number on him, man, like physically, emotionally, all that. And I think if that hadn't happened, there'd be more excitement for this fight. Do you know what I mean? There would definitely be more. I don't think people needed to see a rematch after the second one, but we've got it. And now we're close. I am fully excited, man. I cannot wait. Feel something big happening. I can't imagine this is going to be a dull 12 rounder. I really can't.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope it does go the 12 rounds, because that would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, 12 rounds of beatdown, because Wilder sacked his last corner when they pulled him out. Now, Malik Scott, his new trainer, he's meant to be his mate as well. So I'm wondering if Wilder gets in trouble again, what's going to happen there? Is he going to leave his mate in there to take a potentially dangerous hammering off a 20-stone man who knows how to punch, knows where to hit you, knows how to feint you, knows how to open up all these gaps? That is a worrying aspect of this fight for me.
That's really interesting, actually, thinking about it, because having that sort of relationship, having a very hands-on or a long-standing relationship with somebody that's in a professional atmosphere or professional environment with you, is that going to really cloud his judgment when it comes to making decisions that he should be making professionally, but he'll be making them emotionally? So that's a really interesting dynamic. So, I mean, would you see that is counterproductive for a fighter?
For a fighter, no. I think Wilder's going to get his own way. But for Malik Scott, I think he's put himself in quite a difficult position. We've spoke before about how the conflict of fighters who have their dads in the corner, and are they making professional decisions or are they making personal decisions? I think it is impossible to completely disentangle those things. And that's absolutely why dads who are trainers come under such criticism all the time. I think Malik Scott will leave him in there longer than he needs to if he's taking a hammering.
Which is a problem in itself.
Exactly, yeah. So
it's dangerous for him.
It is dangerous. Oh, taking this fight was dangerous for him, but it's dangerous for Fury too. And that's why I'm excited about it, because there is legit chance for destruction on either side. I know that's really sadistic, isn't it, saying that? But like, that is how I feel, man.
Well, we cannot wait. So it's going to be next week. It's definitely going to be a large review of that fight. Hopefully it does go 12 rounds so we can have a good old chat about it. We've got internationals again this week, haven't we?
Dead. Absolutely dead.
So there's not going to be much review from the football because we've got no Premier League this weekend. So I don't think the next game's until the weekend after, which will be, what, the 17th, I think, around there. So that's awful. So it's going to be, it's next week. It's going to be mainly the combat sports. Hopefully there'll be a bit of US sports we can talk about, something interesting that happens in the NFL we can throw in. But once again, great to get on the podcast with you, as always.
It's been a pleasure, Mark, and I am fully get this happens to me every time I start the podcast thinking, oh, I'm a bit knackered today, I've walked quite a lot, and then by the end I'm like, I can't fucking wait for the weekend sports.
It's just that I'm drained out, I'm mentally just drained out from sports. I think I might just start like disassociating myself from it, but then it's like Thursday, Friday.
Proper Friday, junkie, isn't it?
Saturday what? Oh, shit.
I was just dancing in the bay window and my neighbor is looking at me like I'm a crackhead. I'm just gonna I'm backing away from I'm pulling the curtain in front of me right now.
So there you go. All right, catch you next week, mate. Have a good weekend, and we'll catch up Sunday afternoon. We'll have a chat about the fight.
Can't wait, man. Good to speak to you.